Once upon a time, there was a dog. A dog. A dog. A dog. A dog. Basically, a dog. A dog. Oh, just a basically your common average dog. Just a dog. Nothing special about it. Nothing unspecial about it either. There's no need to go assessing every dog you see and telling everyone, is this a special dog or just a normal, commonplace, nondescript dog? By the way, if it turns out that it's a nondescript dog and you describe it as a nondescript dog, you're contradicting yourself then, because it's descript by the very fact of it being nondescript. Being nondescript is a feature of a dog, and if the dog has a feature that stands out by which he can describe it, then it's not nondescript. As not a nondescript, and not a real nondescript dog would be a dog. Well, I don't know. Probably, there's probably no such thing as a nondescript dog. And don't take that as meaning that all dogs are interesting and fascinating. No, there's just no such thing as a nondescript dog. And it's more to do with language and logic than anything else. It doesn't mean dogs are special. No, it just means there's no such thing as a nondescript dog. Just because it's just illogical. There's no logical basis by which a dog would be nondescript. Because if a dog is nondescript, then it's a nondescript dog. And it has the characteristic of being nondescript, which makes it descript. So. Two dogs walk into a bar. One of the dogs goes straight up to the bar counter and says, "Hello, can I have a pint of your finest dog food, please?" And the man behind the bar says, "Certainly, sir, will Guinness do?" And the dog says, "I don't know. I don't know what dog food is. What even is dog food? It's just some stuff that comes in a bag or a can and you pour it onto a bowl. Can you do that with Guinness? Can you get Guinness in a bag or a can and pour it onto a bowl?" And the man behind the bar says, "Well, you can get it in a can, but this is a pub and we have draft Guinness. So why would you? Why would you want to have a can when we have draft Guinness here?" And the dog says, "Well, I don't know, maybe for convenience. Maybe for convenience, maybe I want to bring some home with me." And the barman says, "Oh, I'm afraid not. We're not licensed to sell takeout Guinness here. We're only licensed to sell it for consumption on the premises." And the dog says, "That's fine, that's fine. I was only looking for some dog food. I wasn't looking for Guinness in the first place. I'm a dog. I don't need to drink Guinness to be drunk as a dog, because I'm already a dog." And the barman says, "Well, hold on now, though. You may already be a dog, but that doesn't mean you're drunk as a dog automatically. It just means you're a dog. But people say drunk. Do they even say drunk as a dog? I don't know. They say sick as a dog. Maybe you're confused. Are you thinking of the term sick as a dog, dog?" And the dog says, "Oh, maybe I am. I thought it was a term drunk as a dog that people use. And I thought maybe you were thinking, if I just have non-alcoholic beverage here, I'll somehow be still the equivalent of drunk as a dog just by being a dog, despite having had no alcohol. And that's not really how it works. At least I don't think it is. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. I have to line my stomach first. Drunk as a dog or no drunk as a dog, I need to have some dog food first. So can I have a pint of your finest dog food, please?" And the man behind the bar says, "Certainly, sir. Would you like a little dram of whiskey? Because that's, I heard that's quite good." And the dog says, "Sir, what in the name of Christ is wrong with you?" He went, "Would you like a dram of whiskey? I heard that's good." That's not something a bar. When does a barman say something like that? And the man behind the bar says, "That's a good point. I suppose in answer to your question, when would a barman say something like that? I would be when there's a dog in front of him ordering some dog food in his bar. And it's got so fucking ridiculous that he's decided he may as well just say whatever he wants, a random, just random words. He may as well say purple dishwasher, monkey nut cat, monkey turnip cat." face screen door something. Make about as much sense as what's going on here, dog. You've taken... Dog, you've come in. You've been in here less than 3 minutes and you've already removed all sense of common sense and normality and logic from this transaction. You have turned my bar upside down, not in the way. I don't mean by running around like a bull in a china shop or whatever the doggual equivalent of a bull in a china shop is. No, you've managed to turn this place upside down metaphorically just by sitting here ordering a bowl of dog food. Which I suppose is quite an achievement. It's quite an achievement. I just don't know what to do with it in terms of making a segment on a podcast. Don't think it's going to be of any use, really, to be perfectly honest. Don't think it's going to be of any use unless it goes somewhere after this. We seem to be having trouble getting anything done today. Been sitting in here now in my bar stroke bare room where I record my podcast stroke serve dogs with Guinness in my bar. I've been in here nearly an hour now and I've only done about 10 minutes of audio. I don't even know whether that's usable. You seem to be having trouble getting going today. Maybe you can help with that dog. You're a dog. Dogs like helping people. I've seen Lassie and the littlest hobo. As well, the littlest hobo, that's that dog. Do you know what the littlest hobo is, dog? The littlest hobo, I should explain, not for you, because you're a dog. I don't need to explain things for a dog. But I'll explain it for the listeners who've never seen the littlest hobo. The littlest hobo was a children's television series about a dog who went around helping people. It was a homeless dog, and every week you would turn up in some new town and help someone with something. And then be that little song that goes, there's a dog walking up down the street. And something, 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 maybe tomorrow I'll try and settle down. Until tomorrow, I'll just keep moving on. That's what the littlest hobo is. There was Lassie as well, which would be considered the superior dog assistance program. But I don't know how well known it is worldwide. There was Lassie was an Australian dog thing. It was a bit like Flipper, except they had a dog instead of whatever Flipper was. Flipper was a dolphin or a sea lion or something. And then there was Skippy. Skippy was a kangaroo. And then... Wait, was Lassie Australian? I'm not sure now. Maybe you're confusing Lassie with the kangaroo. Possibly not. But no, I think the littlest hobo would be more well known internationally. So we'll go with the littlest hobo. I don't know why he was called the littlest hobo. That seems a bit. Maybe he was a bigger. Maybe they mean he was littlest, as in like racist, but against little people. So the dog was prejudiced against little people, and for some reason he put that in his title. He'd go around saying, hello, I'm the littlest hobo. I'm trying to be considerate now, so I'm saying up front that I'm littlest. So anyone who's little, you should avoid me unless you're okay with being offended. And I don't even want to offend you. It's like when you're a leper in the biblical times and they make you go around with a waving a flag in front of you and ringing a bell saying, unclean, unclean. Well, I'm a bigot. I'm an anti-little people bigot and I'm a hobo. So I go around ringing a bell and saying, I'm littlest. If you're a little, you want to stay away from me unless you want me to say extremely insulting littlest stuff. I can't help you understand. It's like a disease I have. I'm a bigot. But I'm the littlest hobo, so I also have other strings to my bow. Luckily, in that I help people in different towns every week, so that's why I get away with it. People in various towns decide, oh, he's only going to be in the town for one episode, and if his record is anything to go by, he's going to help someone out of some situation during the next 50 minutes minus commercials. So we'll put up with his littlest isms for now. And we'll just make him ring a bell saying, oh, I'm littlest, as he goes on to the next town. Of course a dog isn't going to just ring a bell. Because how does a dog ring a bell? Well, I'm not saying a dog can't ring a bell. If a dog is holding a bell in its mouth and wringing her after every few feet to her walks. That's not going to be, the dog's not going to be make, I'm not explaining this very well. If you tell a dog that he needs to ring a bell every minute or two as it progresses along its route, you can't just say, ring it now and then stop ringing it and then just carry the bell for a couple more minutes and then ring it again. No, no, the bell's going to get moved. Unless you know a dog who's done one of those courses where they teach you how to balance a book on your head, like they used to do when they were teaching women how to be posh people. And I don't know, I think people in palaces or something, they teach you how to balance a book on your head, and that's for good posture. Well, if they could teach a dog like the littlest hobo how to hold a bell between rings and while walking, hold the bell in its mouth and have it not ring until it needs to actively ring it, and then it could ring the bell every couple of minutes. But no, that's not possible, so the dog is just going to be ringing the bell by default all the time. And if you're ringing a bell by default all the time, then it just melts into the background. The whole point of a bell or any instrument or sound is to distinguish it from the silence. So you have a bit of silence, and then you have bell ringing, and then a bit more silence, and then you go, oh, someone just rang a bell. If he's ringing the bell continuously because it just rattles because he's carrying it in his mouth, then you're just going to go, oh, there's a continuous bell sound by default associated with that dog. I presume if there's something he needs to tell us, he'll therefore stop ringing it for a few seconds, and that'll be the signal, because the signal can't be that he's ringing the bell because he's just doing that by default all the time. That'd be like telling someone, if you need anything, stop breathing for a moment, and that'll be the signal. No, it's not going to work at all. So that's how the littlest hobo worked. He'd help someone out in the town, and he'd be there for just long enough to help them out, and they'll say, that dog, he's a littlest hobo, he's prejudiced against little people, so we'll make him warn the people in the next village that he goes to that he's littlest. We'll make him have a song, and if he can't perform the song, we'll give him a name. We'll put a name on his collar. It'll say, Littlest Hobo. And then maybe when they press a button on the... Oh, we put a little message on his collar, and we'll press a... He might be going to some village where people can't read, so we'll put a recorded message that gets triggered when someone presses his collar, and it'll say, Attention, this dog is littlest. He's as littlest as be damned. But we let him away with it because he seems to be quite useful and he doesn't stay around too long. So it's quite, we think on balance, it's worth putting up with him for an hour or so in your village because he'll move on then. He's quite a talented dog. The only one thing he can't do is carry a bell and ring it every couple of minutes and then have it not ring for the times between the rings. So that's how a bell isn't really going to work for him. So if it turns out that you're a town that has a lot of leprosy in it and the dog is likely to get leprosy, when you're sending him on to the next town, come up with something better than ringing a bell and shouting unclean, because that's not going to work for the dog. Because as I say, you can't ring a bell. If you can't not ring a bell between the bell ringings thing, that bell isn't going to work. You can't be just having the bell ringing in continuously, because that's the same as being silent continuously. It doesn't work as a signal. That's like if you had a lighthouse and you just left the light on and it wasn't flashing at all. You just had the light on and just shining all over the place in every direction all at once. No, that's not a lighthouse at all. That's just basically the sun, but not as powerful or useful. It's probably using up a lot more power than the sun as well. I know the sun uses up more power than anything else in the galaxy, but it's not power that we have to generate. It's getting the power free from wherever the sun is. What's the sun made of? Something flammable, presumably. Is the moon made of something flammable? That's the question. Is the moon made of something flammable? Because if it is, it'll probably, well, not necessarily, probably, but it might go on fire one day, and then what happens? I suppose it depends on whether there's anyone on it. Is there anyone on the moon at the moment? I don't think so. But if we're on the moon one day and it turns out that it's flammable, and we don't find out that it's flammable until... If the moon turns out to be flammable, there's a good chance the only way we're going to find out about it is if we spend long enough on the moon. And maybe we're going around with mobile phones or something that can trigger the fire, or we have some chemicals or something that interact with whatever's on the moon and starts a fire. We're not going to know how flammable the stuff on the moon is until we spend a lot of time there. That's the issue. So the moon could be extremely flammable and we just don't know about it because we haven't spent enough time there. Last time we went up to the moon, we had a couple of men going around in these, they're wrapped up in these bubbles wrapped around their heads, these suits and bubbles. So they weren't really interacting with the moon at all. So for all we know, the moon could be something that the minute he touches stone on it with your bare hand, it goes on fire. It could be. We didn't test it. We went round with overprotective. That's what we are. We're overprotective of our astronauts, so they're not having to do any proper experimentation. I bet you there's a thing on the moon where as soon as you speak, the sound waves bounce out against the rock or something and the rock goes on fire. That could be. Because we aren't trapping all our sound waves within our suits and just transmitting them through the walkie-talkie system or wherever they have. So we weren't allowing the sound waves to freely travel around and explore the place. So that's an issue there. So that's the moon for you. And that's the littlest hope for you as well. Basically, the moon is on fire. And the littlest hobo is a littlest cunt, but doesn't have leprosy.
Into your head.
We've a lot to get on with today. Items that need to be attended to. Issues that need to be addressed. Topics. Topics. We've got lots and lots of topics. We're positively booming to the scenes with topics. We've got topics coming out of... where's my harmonica? I don't know where my harmonica is. I don't panic. It doesn't mean it's lost. Doesn't mean it's lost. If I say I don't know where the sky is, that doesn't mean the sky is falling in. It just means I don't know where the sky is at this particular moment. I haven't conducted a search for it. I haven't even looked out the window. It's not reasonable to expect to be able to see it when I'm shut in this dungeon of a spare room with my back to the window and the curtains half closed, nothing in my view except the door of a toilet. No, you can't expect me to see the sky from here. But equally, you can't expect me to reasonably declare that the sky is missing just because I can't see it from my current vantage point. It's fairly likely that the sky is there where it always is. Now, it's also very likely that it's not visible even from outside the house. Because in this country, the sky is often not visible from outside of your house. It's often obscured, not by darkness, it's obscured by clouds and stuff. Clouds and stuff, whatever else goes around in the sky. As the sky here is covered in, well, the sky isn't covered in clouds, because the clouds are under the sky. The sky isn't covered in anything. If you think of the sky as a roof, there's nothing on top of the roof. So it's as if you're in a greenhouse. The clouds are underneath the roof of the greenhouse, obscuring the roof, which is the sky. But that doesn't mean the roof is covered in clouds. No, because the clouds are underneath it. So if anything, the sky is covering the clouds. It's obscuring. If the clouds were animate objects who could see, then the clouds' view of outer space would be obscured by the sky. Or would it? No, that's not true though, is it? Because the sky is just empty space. Surely you can see through it if you have the right viewing system. I don't know. Probably doesn't really matter. I'm just saying, there's nothing. The sky is never obscured by clouds. It's just that it's never covered by clouds. Even if it's obscured, the sky could be completely blocked out from our view down here from a completely overcast sky, and it could still be that the sky itself is not covered at all. It could be nothing above the sky at all except empty space. The sky is probably wondering what all the fuss is about. The sky is going, oh, they're saying I'm obscured. They're saying the sky is obscured because of clouds or some crap. But as far as I can see, no, it's not. I'm not obscured at all. I'm perfectly happy up here. There's nothing above me except empty space. Admittedly, it's a bit hard to see at night, but there's nothing to see. Just empty space. Millions and millions and millions of miles. If you were to keep going for a few million miles after you go up above the clouds, after you emerge from above the clouds, and then go up through the sky and go up and up and up and up and up and up and up. You could go for billions of miles and still not encounter anything, unless you happen to point yourself at the nearest planet. And even then, it'd be 100 million miles or something. It's a long way. Things are a long way away once you get up outside of the sky. The last thing that's going to be on your mind, I can tell you, when you're flying through space is whether the sky's obscured by clouds looking from underneath. Because you're not looking at it from underneath anymore. You're looking at it from overneath. You're looking at it from overneath. You're looking at it. Ah, you get the general idea. So I suppose now that you mention it, if you're going travelling in space, at some point you're going to have to come back. And at some point you're going to have to go down through the sky and then down through the clouds that are obscuring it from underneath. And at that point you're going to think, do you want a clear cloudless spot to land in? Because I'm probably going to drop. I'm probably going to be in some little metal tin can thing that's got a parachute attached to it. And it's probably going to land in the sea or something. And I'm going to want to be found. So I better be damn sure that Christ has held that they can find me. But even then, the clouds wouldn't matter then. Unless the clouds are covering the whole sea from the ground up, from the surface of the water right up to space. Then you would have to be all filled with clouds. The only place the cloud is obscuring the view of you from is from above the cloud. So if they're trying to spot you from above the clouds, maybe be using a satellite. That's the irony of it. When you go up in space, so you travel all the way to the moon, and then you travel all the way back, and then you land in your parachute in the middle of the sea. They use satellites, I assume, to locate you so they can come and rescue you. They say, oh, he's landed, he's on the ground now, so we'll send a signal to that thing up in space and ask it where he is. And the thing in space, if it had any sense, would say, that's none of my business. He's not in space anymore. He's landed in the ocean in his little capsule and his parachute, his airless parachute at this point. And I'm flying around in orbit up in space. I'm just a satellite. I don't know what goes on. You're asking me what's going on the ground, down on your planet. You'd know that better than me. You're at a much better vantage point, you, presumably in ground control, to keep an eye on where this fella is. Do you lose track of him as soon as he falls out of space? Because that's a fucking a bit weird. You can track him all the way to the moon. You can track him around the back of the moon. You can even rescue him if he's in an Apollo thing and he gets into trouble on the other side of the moon. You rescue him somehow and make 18 movies about it. But no, he gets back to Earth and lands on the surface of your sea. And your first thought is, oh, I wonder where he is. We'll ask that satellite that's flying around up in space, nowhere near him. Absolutely fucking ridiculous. That's like if you sent up a... if everything that you sent up into space was just a mirror pointed back at her. Now that would be useful if you sent a mirror far enough out into space and you pointed it back at Earth and then you looked into the mirror from here, from the ground, then you might get a look at the Earth during the dinosaur era. You might be able to see some live dinosaurs in the mirror. Perhaps that would be useful. But no, apart from that, no. There's no other reason to be pointing mirrors at space or in space or having satellites going around tracking what's on the ground. The satellites should be tracking what's out beyond. Or maybe they shouldn't be tracking anything at all. Has that occurred to you? It probably hasn't. It hasn't occurred to me either, because I don't see why they shouldn't be tracking anything. It's not against the law to track things. Well, might be against the law to spy on you, perhaps, I don't know. But just in general, as a general thing, as a generality, it's not against the law to track things, especially things in space, and especially things from space. It's not against the law to try and find your astronaut who's fallen in a parachute down from the moon and he's landed in the sea. It's not illegal to try and track him. It should be, in fact, it's probably illegal not to, especially if you're NASA. If he's your employee and he's come back from a business trip that involves landing in the sea with a dinghy and a floating thing and a parachute, and you don't go try and find him where he is and rescue him from the sea, then that's, he could probably bring you to an employee trade union, some sort of thing, and have you get you in trouble. He could bring you up in front of an employer disciplinary censorship board and say, these people, they sent me off on this business trip. They looked after me all the way. We had a bit of trouble when we were going round the moon. We tried to do a slingshot round the moon and there was some problem, but we got out of it. And then we got back to Earth and then they said, this vehicle, it's not capable of landing. So you're going to have to put on a parachute, pull her parachute on the vehicle and then just drop it into the sea. Then just make your way home from there. That's what they said. No, that would be unreasonable. That's unreasonable. If that's the thing with these NASA people, whoever's controlling the, I don't know what the rules are for employees as to how to look after your staff in America. For a party, you can send them all the way up in space in a thing that's likely to burn up on its way out of the atmosphere and on its way into the atmosphere, and that's all perfectly fine. But if you land them in the sea and then you don't come and get them, that's the problem. You say, oh no, he can't make his way home from a fucking thing in the middle of the Pacific. He can find his way home from the moon to Earth, where there aren't even any, signs. There isn't even a system of navigation up in space. There's no satellites to track you or anything. But no, you plop them down in the sea and you leave them there, and then you're just going to be in awful trouble. I think it's because I don't know what I'm getting at here, but suffice to say, no. Suffice to say, it's not okay to just leave him floating in the sea. Not that anyone was planning to, or they, maybe they were, I don't know. I don't know. I presume at one point they were going to leave the Apollo people hanging around the moon in the broken down vessel. If they couldn't fix it, they would have had to leave them there. I was like that fella. There was this fella on, what is it called? Air crash investigations. There was some famous golfer, some famous American golfer whose name I don't know, but who's apparently famous. Something went wrong with his private jet and they couldn't figure out why he wasn't landing. So they went up and they sent a fighter jet up to look at his private jet, and the windows were all fogged up and the plane was going on autopilot. So they just followed it until it crashed. They said, there's nothing we can do about this fella. His windows are all fogged up. So we assume he can't breathe. Maybe there's no air in there, or maybe he's just lost. I don't know. We're just going to follow him. And the air crash investigator said, oh, this is the first time in the history of my job that I've been able to arrive at the air crash scene before the crash has happened. Isn't it absolutely fantastic? Oh, he thought that was hilarious. He didn't express it like that. He didn't say, I think that's hilarious. And he didn't say, ho, 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 at the end of it. Although maybe he did and they edited it out for the programme. If you're going to say that, you better make damn sure that Christ has held that whoever's editing the programme is on your side and they're not going to use it against you. If you're going to put in a little ho 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 after you talk about the plane crash that you're supposed to be investigating, you better be 100% confident that whoever is producing that programme is prepared to edit out your ho ho ho, and that they're not some sort of tabloid scum journalist who's going to quote you on every little sound you make, regardless of whether they think you're serious or not. You better be damn sure to hell as Christ is that. And if you're that sure of everything, then why in the name of Christ did you not save your man before he crashed? You were at the scene before he crashed. Why didn't you stop him? You always go on about how your air crash investigation system is all about preventing crashes. He didn't prevent that crash at all. He just watched your man flying into his death. Flying in a straight line until he ran out of fuel, and then he just plummeted somewhere. Absolutely fucking ridiculous. That's the most ridiculous program on the planet, an air crash investigation. Yeah, the fella on once. This wasn't on air crash investigation. It was on a documentary made in the same style, though. You got an old plane, and the investigator says, I want to crash this plane on purpose in a valley somewhere just to see what happens when it crashes. So he got himself a parachute and he got into the pilot's cab and he flew this big 737 jet or something. And then when they got to the valley, he went out through the back door and through the cargo and jumped out with the plane. And then they watched the plane crash just for fun, just to see if they could figure anything out from crashing an old plane, to see what happens when plane crashes. Get a bird's eye view of a plane crashing. Absolutely fucking ridiculous. Fucking ridiculous. And of course then they were wondering after that why the total number of plane crashes that year went up by one instead of down by several, which you would certainly hope would happen when you successfully investigate a crash by crashing a jet. Maybe they didn't count that plane as a crash because they did it on purpose and it was empty. So then when they improved their rates by saving one or two crashes a year, then they had a net decrease in crashes. I don't know. How do you How do you measure whether you've prevented crashes? You go around counting how many shitty pilots there were and how many shitty planes and ask them, how many times would you normally expect to crash on a year like this? And have you crashed less times or more times than you would expect to in a normal year? Because you want a customer satisfaction survey when you're doing a job as valuable as that. Otherwise, what's the point? If you can't measure whether you're having an effect, what's the bloody point? If you're a fireman and you can't find out how many lives you've saved, then you might as well just say, oh, I just do nothing then. If the net effect is, what does that even mean? I don't know. I've left a bit late in the day today to record, so my caffeine is wearing off. I don't know if it's obvious. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. Anyway, on with the show.
Have a comment, question, or topic request? Email Neil anytime, studio@intoyourhead.ie. Remember, we value the opinions of you, the humble and ignorant listener.
Hobos walk into a bar. One of the littlest hobos goes straight up to the bar counter and says, hello, can I have a pint of your finest Guinness, please? And the man behind the bar says, no, I don't think so. I don't think so, sir. I don't think you can have a pint of my finest Guinness, or any of my Guinness for that matter. I don't think so. And the littlest hobo says, may I ask why? And the man behind the bar says, I think we all know why, sir. I think we all know why. You're the littlest hobo, and I'm a little person. I'm a little barman in here, just a little barman in here trying to run a bar. I've been warned about you. You warned me about you by carrying the name Littlest Hobo, so I know straight up front what your motivation is, your littlest. I don't care about the hobo part, that's fine. I presume hobo just means you're a dog who's homeless or something. In fact, is hobo what people call homeless people in some countries? I think maybe it is. Maybe I should look that up. But this is a bar. Suffice to say, no, I don't think you can have a pint of my finest Guinness, or any other kind of Guinness for that matter. And the littlest hobo says, so that means you're hoboist, doesn't it? You're prejudiced against me. I've barely spoken a word yet and you've already decided that I'm littlest. Just because of my name. It isn't even my name. It's just the name of the program. That's not my name. I'm a homeless dog. I don't have a name. A name is just what people call me. Most of the time they just say, here, doggy, 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 doggy. Nobody knows my name. It's really weird that people even know that I'm the littlest hobo. Now, how does that work exactly? Because I go from town to town and somehow I'm known as the littlest hobo. Do people go, oh, I must look up. I don't know what type of dog that is. I'll take a photograph of it and then I'll do an image search on Google on my phone and it'll turn up and it'll say, that's the littlest hobo. That's what that is. And they just assume, apparently they just assume that if this says littlest hobo, that means I'm anti-little people. If I said racist hobo, would you assume that I meant I was against black people? He probably would. Not occurring to you that maybe I'm a black dog and I'm racist against white people. And the man behind the bar says, sir, what in the name of Christ? What in the name of Jesus Christ are you going? This made a lot more sense in that previous segment that you accidentally deleted. And the dog says, I know that. It's very hard to do the same thing all over again from scratch and reproduce it. And that's not really how this program works. This program is supposed to be original thoughts on the fly. And the man behind the bar says, oh, the fly, is it? You're on about flies now, is it? You've some issue with flies. I suppose they're even smaller than me, so you have a huge problem with flies, the fact that they're small. You think, oh, that's a tiny little fly. You're probably scared. To be fair, there's a lot to be afraid of in something the size of a fly. It could fly up your nose and you're never quite sure whether you've inhaled a fly or not. And you're thinking for the rest of the night, should I pick my nose and see if it comes out? Or should I pick my nose and just not look at what comes out and just hope that if there's a fly up there, it's come out? That's what you're thinking. And then the littlest hobo will say, oh, you're showing your true colours now there. You're accusing me of being littlest because you think I'm prejudiced against you, a small barman. Well, now you're going on about how you're even more littlest than me because you're against tiny little flies that are much smaller. And the barman says, that doesn't make me more littlest than you. If anything, it makes you more littlest than me. Because if you have a problem with something my size, but you don't have a problem with flies, but I have a problem with flies, but I'm fine with something your size, that means I'm only prejudiced against the very, 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 very small stuff. You're prejudiced against stuff that, like me, that's not even on the way to being as small as a fly. I'm just a smaller than average person, and you're again, you have a problem with me, you're a littlest against me, but then you're trying to accuse me of being littlest just because I have a problem with a fly that's small enough to get up my nose. No, no, I'm far less littlest than you. I'm fine with anything that's bigger than a fly. You're against anything that's my size or smaller. Christ almighty, you know, you got a fucking... I think this guy, you go around from town to town here now, you get all... Oh, you get all this praise because of all your... Whatever you do, I don't know what it is you do. Do you help people or something? Is that it? And the littlest hobo says, wait a minute now, hold on a minute. Did we start this segment with two little... Oh no, we did. I'm trying to remember, am I supposed to be the littlest hobo in the bar? Because if I wasn't, then this wouldn't make sense. Well, it does make sense, that's why. So you can delete this part of the thing where I'm trying to remember whether this was a littlest hobo walks into a bar story. Because it was. So we can continue on from here. Edit, 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 edit. This is an edit point. Edit, edit, edit. And the man behind the bar says, sir, I think you're thinking too much about your television program. If you're worrying about where you're going to edit everything, Jesus Christ. Well, yeah, relax, relax. You're like one of those travel programs where they go around and you think everything they do has to be about making their documentary. You go, oh, there's that dog. And the dog goes, what do you mean they'll go, but there's that dog? And the barman says, I don't know. I think I'm fucking this segment up. That's what I think. And the littlest hobo says, why? Well, if you're fucking this segment up, then you're fucking my whole series up. Because I'm part of a program where I go to a different town every week. And if you fuck up part of my series, one episode of my series, that's a whole segment of my journey you've ruined. So I'm probably off course for the next several episodes then. I've probably got people chasing me thinking I've got leprosy or something because I ring my bell. And then I've got, and the man behind the bar says, have you been ringing your bell, sir? And the littlest hobo says, yes, I have. I've been ringing my... They gave me a bell the last town that I was in. I said, oh, I'm not sure about this, but I'll humour them. I'll give it a try. So I put the bell around my neck and started walking. And I said, I'll ring my bell every minute or two. And I noticed that the bell was rattling just as I walked along. Bell was just ringing all the time. So having a bell ringing all the time is of no value at all. You might as well have no bell at all. It's like if you have a car with a horn on it, but the horn is stuck, so it's stuck on beeping. So you're just going beep, 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 non-stop 24/7. That's not going to get you anywhere. And the man behind the bar says, that's true, that's true. Anyway, would you like a pint of my finest Guinness? Forget whether you'd already asked for one and I denied you because you're the littlest hobo. I begin to think there's more to you than the littlest thing at the moment, so I'm going to try and keep an open mind. Which is more than you do to me. And the littlest hobo says, well, at least I'm not prejudiced against a fly that gets stuck up your nose. I mean, Jesus Christ, if a cat got stuck up your arse by accident because you sat on it, will you decide you have some problem with cats then? That's fucking ridiculous. You're blaming the victim. That's victim shaming is what you're doing there. If you inhale a fly... You're the problem, not the fly. The problem is you're... This is if the fly was here millions and millions and millions of years before you. A fly is happily flying around in a space that you've managed to build a bar around and you've enclosed it in this space without even consulting the fly. This was the fly's property long before we humans ever existed. It was open spaces and you built the... What's that Billy Joel song? Well, I mean, that's what it reminds me about. Because the flies are the equivalent of the narrator in that Billy Joel song, No Man's Land. It goes something like, Who remembers when the all began? Out here in no man's land. It's not a very well-known song, but suffice to say it's about what the suburbs were like before anything got built in them, before they brought in all their cinemas and shopping centres and things, and before they brought in the pubs that they where they build a pub building around a space that would normally be full of flies that can fly freely around. And you just built your bar around it. And the Billy Joel song goes something like, how's it go? Well, the lyrics don't really matter that much. Suffice to say, he says, who remembers when the all began? Out here in no man's land. Before they launched their marching plans. Out here and then there's stuff about. Now we're going to get the close circuit. Now we're going to get the prime time. Now we're going to get the sports franchise. Everybody's all excited about it. And the man behind the bar says, that's fucking ridiculous. You're trying to bring a Billy Joel song, trying to fashion a Billy Joel song into some narrative about how I've taken over the spare empty spaces from some fly. Some fly that was born about 3 minutes ago and has no memory of what this place was like before the bar was built. As far as the fly is concerned, the bar is the universe. He's probably spent half of his 3 minute life trying to figure out if there's anything outside of the known universe, and the known universe to him is just this bar top here. Well, there is nothing outside of this known universe, fly. But if you want to find out properly, go and have a sniff of this alcohol-soaked cloth. I'll swat you with, or maybe I'll swat you with a newspaper. That's the traditional way to deal with a fly. You get a newspaper and you smash it up on the fly's head. Except you're not really smashing it against the fly's head, as you can't just hit it. There's no way you can hit a fly on the head. You're hitting the whole fly or nothing, or no fly at all. There's no way to zone in on a particular part of a fly, unless you're using some sort of microscopic tools of some sort, and you're a surgeon. In which case, if you're a surgeon and you're dealing with a fly and you just decide to kill a string, you know, business. Why would a surgeon with microscopic instruments be interacting with a fly in a way that he doesn't want to kill us? That doesn't make any sense at all. Do they operate on flies? I don't mean do people bring their flies to a vet and have them operated on to save their lives. No. I just mean, is there someone experimenting on flies? Because they experiment on rats and things. They do brain surgery on rats. Why wouldn't they do on a fly? Maybe because it's too small. Maybe that's why. But maybe, surely, to Christ, there's ways to... If you have these surgeons are supposedly very accurate people with steady hands, and they can operate on anything small, and they can clip a blood vessel or find little veins and connect bits of your brain to other bits of your brain. Surely to Christ, a fly isn't too much for them. Surely you can put a big magnifying glass in front of it. I don't know. Surely they can do microscopy stuff on the fly. And there'd be a lot to learn. If you can learn how to save a fly's life through surgery, the world is our oyster then. If you get to the point where mending medical science where surgeons can operate on a fly and do a meaningful surgery on them that saves their life, then there's nothing they can't do. So maybe they should be doing that. That's why we should be operating on flies. Don't get me wrong, it's not that I want to save the fly's life or anything, or improve the fly's life in any way. It's just, if we can operate on flies, that's a good challenge to get us. It's like the way, I don't think we should be going to Mars. If we go to Mars, we might learn stuff that advances humanity, so we do it anyway. I don't think we should be saving flies' lives, where if you perform surgery on flies with a view to seeing if their lives can be saved, and that'll help us progress medical science, I suppose so. And the littlest hobo says, so you're saying if we learn how to perform brain surgery, for example, on the fly, that'll somehow help us with brain surgery on humans? And the man behind the bar says, well, when you put it like that, it sounds a bit silly. I think it's a lot more. If there was a choice between hitting a fly over the head with a, where an implement such as a rolled up newspaper, which you can't really do accurately because you're hitting the whole fly. You know, if you're hitting a fly with a newspaper and you say, oh, I slapped that fly on the head and knocked it out good, you're kidding yourself. You're lying to yourself. You didn't smack that fly in the head. You just smacked the whole fly. The whole fly and nothing but the fly all in one go. And stop fooling yourself that you've done some accurate thing where you smacked it on the head. You did not. You smacked the whole fly. You don't even know how the fly dies when you do that. You could be hitting it on the balls of its feet and making its legs disappear up into its legal cavity. So basically squashing the legs up into the fly. It's like if someone came along and smacked a joint newspaper into you, but you're so small and they're so big and the newspaper's so big that they don't know what part of you they're hitting with. They could be hitting you on the top of the head. They might get lucky and hit you on the top of the head and that'll knock you out. But they also might, for all they know, they could be hitting you on the balls of your feet, and they could be pushing your feet with such pressure that your legs go up inside your torso and you die that way. Or they could be hitting you on the back, and then they could be making you bend so far that your chest goes out that way and the rest of your body goes the other way, and they basically bend you to death. They have no idea what way they're killing you. If a joint kills you with a joint rolled up newspaper, they have no way of knowing what way they're killing you. All they know is you're there 1 minute and the next minute you're gone. And it's the same with us human beings and a fly. So that's why it might be worthwhile learning how to operate on a fly, because it'll help us with other stuff. We can learn to be that accurate. And you know what I mean. It's better than just smashing the fly to death anyway, isn't it? And the littlest hobo says, you're a fucking weirdo, sir. You're a fucking weirdo. I think I'm ready to go on to my next town now. I mean, Jesus Christ almighty. You're a man in a bar and you're telling me, a little dog who helps everyone, telling me, I'm not going to go into what you're telling me. Suffice to say, you're telling me all that. And it's fucking ridiculous. That's what it is. I think what you're trying to do. You've heard that I'm the littlest hobo and you're afraid to, you'd want to just kick me out of the bar, but you're afraid that the people who've heard about the littlest hobo coming to help the town, you're afraid they'll think that I'm just trying to, you're afraid they'll blame you for not letting me stay long enough to help whoever I'm here to help, because I haven't announced who I'm here to help yet. If you know what's that, that's because I haven't realised who I'm here. It's the beginning of the episode. I don't know what I'm in this town for yet. I've just arrived. No doubt at some point I'll find out someone who needs help and I'll help them. But if you send me off now into the next town before I've even done anything, then there's going to be people in this town who will hold it against you for the rest of your life. They'll hold it against you for the rest of your life, and you need to bear that in mind. And they're prepared to let me stay for the hour, because they know I'm littlest, but they've made a calculation where they say, that hobo who's against little people, he's also quite good at helping people, so we'll put up with his littleism for an hour or so. We'll keep him away from little people and warn them not to go near him because he's a cunt, but he serves a purpose, so we let him stay for a day or two in the town till he helps someone, and then you go off into the next episode. I suppose he could have got Lassie instead, but Lassie isn't a hobo. Lassie, if I understand correctly, Lassie has a home, or does he? Wait, does Lassie have a home? I'm not sure now. I know he has some kid who he befriends, but does he live with the kid and his family, or is he homeless? I'm not sure. And then there's Skippy. Skippy belonged to someone, I'm not sure. Skippy's a fucking kangaroo, so it's unlikely that he'd be here in this story. Is it? Unless this story is set in Australia, is it? I don't think it is. We don't usually state where the story is set, other than in a bar. Surely if this was set in Australia, he'd have said, can I have a pint of your finest Foster's, please? And then everyone would break down in laughter. They'd say, Foster's, that's a fucking stereotype if ever I heard one. Or everyone's fine with the Guinness. They'd say, oh no, you can say a pint of your finest Guinness, please, in your Irish accent. And no one thinks, no, that's insulting. They might as well say Paddy Irishman walked into a bar then. But no, if you come along and say, Gippy walks into a bar and says, can I have a pint of your finest Foster's, please? Adrian will say, that's fucking ridiculous. You can't say that. I remember. This is me, the narrator, talking now. Not the narrator of the Littlest Hobo television program. The narrator of this podcast. If you back up two levels from where we are now, because you're in the middle of a Skippy thing being talked about by the Littlest Hobo in a bar, in a two Littlest Hobos walk into a bar story in a podcast. You go back up a few levels to where until you're at the fella, say, doing the podcast, and that's me, the narrator. So that's me now who's talking. I remember once I went on holidays to Spain. We had our holiday. We had our holiday apartment broken into. Someone smashed open the safe, and they smashed open the press that the safe was in. I didn't take anything out of the safe, just left us, but removed a box of Fosters that were sitting in the kitchen press. I don't think it was even refrigerated. I have imported from Ireland, so they stole that. So I don't know where. Maybe that's entertaining to you, or maybe it isn't. I don't. Maybe it needs a bit more. I've been developing that story since I was about 18. It was some time ago. So it's probably, maybe I should develop it further before I use it on here. I just came up because Foster's came up. Anyway, on with the show. Two returning NASA astronauts from the Apollo 24 moon lander walk into a bar. One of the returning astronauts goes straight up to the bar counter and says, "Hello, could I have a pint of your finest Guinness, please? And do you have a telephone that I could use? I need to phone home, so to speak." As E.T. might say, had he arrived in the same way as I did. Oh, that's a little joke for you. And the man behind the bar says, "Certainly, sir. But are you not still on duty? Should you be drinking if you haven't been even being rescued yet, presumably? Because you've still got a parachute trailing after you. Hope it worked a bit better than it's working now while you were flying down through the air." Well, presumably it did. Unless that's the... Did you have a second backup parachute, and the one that's flopping down behind you on the ground was just the first one that failed? And the parachutist says, "I don't think you know what the fuck you're talking about, barman. No offence or anything, but the reason the parachute is trailing after me on the ground is because it was successful. It landed me on the ground, and then it emptied the air, and then it flopped back on the ground, because you don't want it. You don't want it building up a current again, and it'd go taking off again. Happy like your man did." Oh, that happened with your man, Richard Branson. He did that. He did that flying across on a balloon across the Atlantic thing. And then he was running out of steam over Northern Ireland, and he got out in his parachute. And he landed on the ground. He got right down to the ground. He landed on some farmer's ground in Northern Ireland. But then he took off again in the parachute. Ended up going flying up back up into the air again. Oh no, that was the balloon, not the parachute. But still. The whole point of a parachute is it needs to empty out when you get to the ground so you don't take off again. You don't ever want to be taking off in a parachute. It's very difficult to control. You could end up, somewhere else, and then you don't know where you are. That's why I've always wondered about these parachutes, barman. How do people know where they're going to land? I don't know. Haven't really had much time to think about it, because I'm just back from Mars. I've been on this long trip on Apollo 24, and you would imagine that a big part of the trip would be planning for the fact that I'm going to land in a parachute in the middle of the sea somewhere conveniently close to this bar. But no, that was a very small proportion of my training, because there was so much else going on. Because during the trip itself, we had to go to Mars and back. There was all this stuff going on in space. So the end of the trip was basically just an afterthought. Luckily, I was a parachutist before I became an astronaut, so I was perfectly fine. I know what I'm doing, so I'm landed here. As I say, I just need to phone home, as they say, like E.T. I go, "E.T., phone home, ho, 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 ho." So anyway, yes, can I use your phone, please? And the man behind the bar says, "Certainly, sir. Here's the phone. Just tap in the PIN code before you start, because my phone is locked. The PIN code is, 'Fuck off, you cunt.'" And the astronaut says, "I beg your pardon." The barman says, "Oh, I was just saying my phone is locked, so before you use it, you'll have to type in the PIN to access it, to unlock it, before you can dial your number. And as I say, the PIN number is, fuck off, you cunt." And the astronaut says, "Is this some sort of a joke? Because I'm not seeing the light side of it. Seems to be just an opportunity for you to claim to be doing a joke, but just to tell an astronaut who's just being literally to Mars and back to fuck off that he's a cunt. That seems a bit much." And the astronaut says, "Well, excuse me, young man. You think just because you've been to Mars and back, because you've been into space, that somehow means you have to have the automatic adoration of every human being on the Earth. Well, some of us don't like Mars, and some of us don't like the fact that you're making friends with the Martians. Some of us find it rather obscene and offensive. Some of those Martians, for all we know, could have been bombing our country billions of years ago. Some of them might have wiped out the dinosaurs. Now you might think, oh, the dinosaurs were no great loss, they're these scary creatures. Well, they weren't scary in those days, I can tell you. They're only scary to us because of scale, because they're 50 times the size of the average human. But if we'd been made to the same scale as the dinosaurs, and we happened to live in the same era on which they dominated the Earth, then we'd have been a lot less scared of them. We'd probably have made pets out of them, or they'd have made pets out of us. We'd be like their dogs. We'd be going around going, hello, dinosaur, I'm your best friend and dog, except I'm a human. I'm not a dog, I'm a human. But in this era of the dinosaurs, a human is a pet. We might even be bigger than the dinosaurs. We have dogs now that are quite big. I know most of them aren't as big as your average adult human. But humans also have ponies and horses as pets sometimes. And those are bigger than humans. So there's no reason why a dinosaur couldn't have had a human pet who's bigger than a dinosaur. And for all we know, maybe the dinosaurs were very small and their fossils... I'll bet you we're going to find out one of these days that one of the things that happens to fossils when they sit in the ground for billions of years is that they swell up and become 50 times bigger than they actually originally were. Why wouldn't they? A fossil is basically a hollowed out space inside a rock that used to be occupied by bone. So there's no reason why you shouldn't swell up. Be some sort of greenhouse gases fill up and occupy the space and then push it out and make the fossil bigger. I don't know. Maybe that's the case. And the astronaut says, "Are you quite finished, sir?" And the barman says, "Oh, yes, I am, I am. I was only joking about the phone. It's over there. It's an old payphone over there. Now, you probably haven't got much change with you. I'm assuming you don't travel with a lot of spare coins when you're going to the moon and back and Mars and back. Because I know they weigh everything. I know when they went to the moon, they weighed everything and they planned for every ounce of rock that they're going to bring back from the moon. They said, how much rocks are you picking up? Make sure you find the rocks that together add up to exactly 742 ounces, no more and no less." In fact, half the time they spent on the moon, they were going out trying to find rocks that weighed exactly that much. I don't know if you've ever tried weighing a rock on the moon in the late 1960s. It's quite difficult. It's quite difficult, especially when you're the first person who's ever done it. And nobody's figured out quite how it works yet. All the non-gravity and stuff. Because there's basically no air there. You put something down on the weighing scales over there and straight away starts floating away. Both the weighing scales and the rock start to float away. You probably have to do something that involves measuring which is floating away faster, the rock or the weighing scales, and then you get out a calculator. Of course, the pilots would be very good at that. The pilots who become astronauts, they're well used to doing calculations. Every time you take off in a plane of any kind, you have to calculate how much weight is on the plane. And how fast are we, what's going to be our takeoff velocity and how far we down the runway will we be before we're able to lift off? So the people who landed on the moon, they're no stranger to that sort of thing. Unless, of course, they're one of the astronauts who didn't happen to be a former pilot. Maybe your one who was a teacher and she became an astronaut on the Challenger. Although they never made it to the moon. Were they even going to the moon? I don't think so. I don't know. But they blew up just as they were. You probably don't want to hear this story, sir, an astronaut. Wait, am I the barman talking or am I the astronaut? I've lost track. Christ, there wouldn't be much use on a spaceship, would I? I can't even keep track of which person I am in this dialogue. Oh, I hope I'm not the astronaut, am I? And the man behind the bar says, no, you are the astronaut. Oh no, wait a minute, I'm not sure. I'd have to listen back to the segment. I'm not sure whose turn it was to talk and which of us was saying all that. Fubby, let's just leave it. People can figure it out themselves. As the people who are listening to this are probably paying more attention to it than we are. It was understandable. One of us is just literally falling out of the sky on a parachute and landed in the middle of the sea and somehow found this bar. Oh, by the way, did you land in the sea? Because you're in my bar now. Did you just land in the middle of the sea and manage to make your way all the way to this bar? And you're only now thinking of calling your employer. Is that what happened? What were you going to do if you weren't very near land? Were you just going to put a message in a bottle or something? And the astronaut says, oh, no, you misread this situation, sir. I was already in contact with them when I landed. Or they were with me anyway. Or I was wearing a signal thing that they could pick up on the satellite. The satellite spotted me and then they sent the signal down to ground control. They said, your man's down there, he's at these coordinates. And they sent a message back to me via the satellite saying, that's fine, make your own way to the nearest town. Use that little dinghy you've got. It'll help build up your muscles again because you've been away for several weeks in zero gravity and your muscles are basically, they haven't been in use at all. And when that happens, your muscles are completely useless. The only way to get them working again is by exercise. So they said, row your little dinghy there until you get to the coastline and then ring us from a nearby bar. So I said, that's fine, I'll do that. It took me a while to get going, I can tell you. Luckily, the sea and the water in the sea is quite buoyant. So I was able to just float for a while as I figured out how to get my hands working again. And then eventually I was able to swim. And I got stronger and stronger as a swimmer. By the time I'd figured out how to swim at my full normal rate, I was basically nearly here. And then I was here. So then I got to the beach. And I saw a bar up here. Well, I didn't see the bar. I saw the building. I saw the outside of a building, which on close examination I could assess was probably a bar. Because it said bar on a sign above the entrance. It said, this is a bar. And then there was another sign on the door that says, this is the door that leads into a bar, unless you're coming at it from the opposite side, in which case it's the door that leads into the outside world. Although not quite as outside as the outside world that I've just returned from by parachute. No. Thankfully not, because I don't think I'm quite ready to go into zero gravity, zero air land again just yet. No. Anyway, can I have a pint of your finest Guinness, please? I hear they give that to people who've just given blood, because it's good for you. As I believe the advertisements used to say in the 1950s, they said, Guinness is good for you. Drink Guinness and have loads of cigarettes. That's what I used to say. I'll pass on the cigarettes. We'll have a pint of Guinness, please. And the man behind the bar says, sir, I'm not serving a pint of Guinness to a man who's just fallen out of the sky. Would you? Don't be fucking ridiculous. I've called an ambulance. I'm going to tell the ambulance people to give you the once over and make sure you're still alive and make sure there's nothing wrong with your brain. Cause you've been going around in zero oxygen for several weeks. And by the way, you say you're up in space for several weeks. My understanding is that getting to Mars takes about a year or something like that, or at least 6 or 7 months, depending on the positioning of the planets at the time. How did you manage to do it in several weeks? And the astronaut says, oh, I made a mistake there. I didn't go to Mars. I went to the moon. A force of habit, really, because I was supposed to be going to Mars, but Yeah, and I was planning on going to Mars. We're forced to, we're so used to going to the moon or trying to go to the moon. We've been doing it for 50-odd years. Some of the technicians down on ground control, just out of basically out of muscle memory, they had all controls set to send me to moon instead of Mars. And I was quite a surprise when I saw the moon coming up in my front view mirror, I can tell you. Now I know what you're thinking. What in the name of Christ would a front view mirror be? Well, it's the opposite of a rear view mirror. Because if you're in a, sometimes if you're in a rocket ship like I was, it's advantageous to sit facing the back, facing the opposite direction to the direction in which you were going. And if that's the case, it's appropriate to have a front view mirror. It's a mirror outside of the, well, sometimes it's outside of the back passenger seat window, or sometimes it's in the middle of the back window and it's pointing the front, so you can see what's outside of the front windscreen in the mirror. And the man behind the bar says, well, obviously, it's fairly obvious, I think, to anyone with a brain what her front view mirror would be, even if you never heard of one before. I mean, for self-explanatory, front view mirror clearly is the opposite of a back view mirror. And your astronaut says, well, not exactly the opposite, no, because the opposite of a rear view mirror would be a mirror that's showing, I don't know, maybe now, I don't know. Because there's different ways of doing opposites, you see. It's the opposite of a front view mirror. It could be showing you a view of the back, but it could be, or it should be, could be showing you, it could be showing an image of you to whoever's outside at the front of the car. Oh no, I don't know. Maybe I'm overthinking it. And the man behind the bar says, indeed you are. Anyway, good morning.